Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers, and it's episode 105. Today, we're talking about law enforcement authority to stop somebody who you have reasonable suspicion may be armed. And we're going to talk about what should be a very simple question. Let's say an officer is driving down the street in a high crime area, and they witness an individual who appears to be carrying on or about their person a concealed handgun. Does that officer have lawful authority to stop that person, pat them down, and confirm or dispel the suspicion that they're carrying that firearm unlawfully? Seems like a simple question. And yet, we're going to find that there was a ruling this week from the Virginia Court of Appeals that says, yes, a law enforcement officer does have authority, but that ruling directly contradicts a ruling from just 2020, from just a few years ago. So we're going to have to kind of dive into this issue and see if we can determine the answer. Let's go back to the ruling from 2020. This was a ruling we've talked about, I think, many times before, and it's an unpublished ruling. And it's important to note that the ruling from 2020 and the ruling from this week are both unpublished cases, which means that they're not supposed to have precedential value, and they can't bind even the Court of Appeals in the future. They're simply cases that you can look at, and they can be persuasive, but not controlling. And that's actually really important because, as you're going to see in the case from this week, the Court of Appeals completely ignores this case from 2020, which they kind of have to do to get to their ruling, I guess. But anyway, so let's talk about what happens in the 2020 case, and then we'll talk about the case from this week. So in the 2020 case, this is a case where the defendant is a convicted felon and he's carrying a concealed handgun on or about his person. It happens in the city of Richmond in an area called Creighton Court. And this is certainly a high crime area, but it's important to point out here that in this case, the fact that Creighton Court is a high crime area is not testified to or established on the record. Instead, what the Commonwealth focuses on and what the officers focus on in this case is that the area is a no trespassing area. And in the course of their investigation and their patrolling of this area, they stop Mr. Johnson on suspicion that he's trespassing in the area. Now, during the course of the stop for trespassing, they see a bulge, or what they describe as a bulge, in the defendant's front left waistband that was completely covered by his shirt. They speak to him about what he's doing there, because again, they're doing a trespassing investigation, but they can see that Johnson is fidgeting with his jacket, trying to turn the left sleeve right side out and kind of put it out on his arm. And he tells the officers that his right arm was covered in bandages because he had been shot in the arm. At that point, the officers say, "Do you have any weapons on him?" And he says, "No." And the officer says, "Well, my partner's going to pat you down." And they go to pat him down, but before he does, the officer lifts up Johnson's shirt and reveals the firearm, and they seize the firearm and so on. So the defendant moves to suppress, and they have this argument in court about whether or not there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe that Johnson was trespassing. The important thing to know about that is that the trial court ultimately decides that, or rules that, there wasn't sufficient reason to believe that Johnson was trespassing. And that issue never goes to the Court of Appeals. So we have to assume in this case that the officers didn't have a lawful reason to stop Johnson for trespassing. That's going to be part of our setup of facts. What we are left with then is this bulge in Johnson's pocket. And the officer testifies that he can see the bulge in the defendant's pants when he gets out of his patrol vehicle, but he can only see that it's an L-shaped bulge after Johnson turns around and he gets about 3 feet away from Johnson. And at that point, based on his training and experience, the officer says the L-shaped bulge looked consistent with a firearm and that he believed that Johnson was armed. This officer said that he couldn't tell what the bulge was specifically until he lifted the shirt. So it's a little confusing, the officer can't say for sure, oh yeah, this is a firearm, but he suspects that it's a firearm. And that articulation is going to be important, I think, ultimately, when we see what the court rules here. But the court here says that this is a search and not a pat-down, so it requires probable cause. Lifting up the shirt is, in the eyes of the court, a search and not a Terry frisk. Now, you might not agree with that. You might say, well, no, that would be part of a frisk. But again, importantly in this case, the Commonwealth conceded, no, we think this is a search also. And so the court never addresses, well, what if they had done it as a Terry pat-down? Would it have been lawful to pat Johnson down? We don't get to that question. We're only investigating whether or not they had probable cause to believe that Johnson was committing an offense. And so the court here says, and they write, and this is just Judge Humphreys, who's just retiring this year, an individual has a fundamental constitutional right under the Second Amendment to bear arms, and the exercise of that right cannot, without more, establish probable cause for either a search or a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. Therefore, the presence of a bulge under a shirt suggesting one is armed is not automatically indicative of criminal activity. As the Supreme Court recognized in Heller, now that's one of the famous U.S. Supreme Court cases where the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that people have a right to bear arms and the government is limited in its ability to regulate whether or not somebody is allowed to own a firearm at all. Here, the Supreme Court recognized in Heller, although the Second Amendment does not protect the right of citizens to carry arms for any sort of confrontation, states may impose limited restrictions on the possession of firearms. The Second Amendment right is exercised individually and belongs to all Americans. So the court then turns to Virginia's way of implementing that, which is Virginia's concealed carry permit. And the court here writes, an individual's choice to exercise his fundamental right to bear arms cannot standing alone serve as a basis for reasonable suspicion or probable cause that in doing so he's committing a crime. Thus, we do not presume that an individual carrying a concealed firearm must be in violation of the law in doing so. If there are other indicia of criminality present, the presence of a bulge consistent with a weapon can be considered under the totality of circumstances in determining whether or not reasonable suspicion or probable cause existed. So what the court allows for in Johnson is, well, if these facts had been different, if in fact in this case, for example, the court says that Johnson had been engaged in nervous or furtive behavior, well, that might give the officer a lawful reason to believe that he's carrying the firearm unlawfully. But in this case, the court says the only basis for the seizure of the firearm was the fact that the officer sees the bulge in Johnson's waistband. The court says the officers were not aware of any complaints that a crime had been committed by somebody matching Johnson's description. There was no evidence that the officers stopped him for acting suspiciously in a high crime or drug market area. That's interesting because, of course, again, we know the real reason why Johnson is stopped is because he's suspected of trespassing. But again, because of, you know, the way that the case comes in, that issue never gets to the court. But I want you to remember the statement the court makes that there's no evidence that the officers stopped Johnson for acting suspiciously or stopped him in a high crime area. Because the fact that there's no testimony that Johnson isn't stopped in a high crime area becomes important when we talk about the new case from the Court of Appeals this week, which is the Alvin case from the Court of Appeals. So we're going to get to that in a minute. But here the court says also in Johnson, the record reveals no attempt to determine whether or not Johnson was a convicted felon. Ultimately he was, but the officers didn't know that, or that he didn't have the lawful ability to have a concealed carry permit, or he didn't have a concealed carry permit. And so the court says the mere presence of the bulge that's consistent with a concealed carry of a firearm without more doesn't create probable cause that a crime is being committed. There's no indication of criminality other than the suspicion that he's armed. And so the court rules there's no probable cause to believe that contraband or evidence of a crime would be uncovered by a search of his person. And the court agrees that the trial court lawfully suppressed the evidence. Okay, so now we turn ourselves to this case, Alvin versus Commonwealth, which is the case from just this past week. And here, the defendant, who's a convicted felon, carries a concealed firearm on his person, just like in the Johnson case. And while on a patrol, an officer sees the defendant walking with, again, an object that appears to be a firearm in his person, just like in the Johnson case. Here, the officer's description is very detailed. He describes how he sees the defendant walking with a heavy object swinging in his right pocket every time he takes a step forward. They're in a neighborhood in Norfolk in a marked patrol vehicle. Mr. Alvin is walking in a path on the opposite side of the street, And he describes the pants as being made of a thin fabric and says the object that's swinging in his pocket appears heavier than a cell phone. Every time that Alvin did take a step forward with his right leg, the officer could see the object pressed against the side, the inside of his pants pocket on the right side, between the pants pocket and his leg. Through the thin fabric, the officer testified that he could clearly see an outline of a firearm against his leg, including the handle of a firearm and the barrel of a firearm. And he pointed the defendant, at that point, he pointed Alvin out to his partner, and both of them walked up and got out of the car, stopped the car, got out, said, "Hey man, hold up a second, get over here." They stop Alvin, they ask him, "Do you have any ID? Do you have a concealed carry permit?" And then immediately pat him down, and they remove a .380 caliber pistol. Ultimately, he doesn't have a concealed carry permit, and he's a convicted felon. And so they charge him with possession of a firearm, a convicted felon. Here, the trial court denies the motion to suppress instead of being granted like it did in the Johnson case. And the defendant appeals to the Court of Appeals. So, you know, we have the same issue, basically, right? And the first thing I'm going to say is it's really interesting that the Court of Appeals in this case, and here it's Judge Decker, who is the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, doesn't in any way mention the Cummell versus Johnson case from 2020. And by the way, has no requirement of doing so. We've talked before about unpublished cases, but unpublished cases have no binding authority. So the court doesn't really have an obligation to acknowledge the existence of this contrary ruling from 2020 because the court's not bound by it. But it is a little unusual not even to acknowledge that there was a contrary ruling. It's a little, you know, it's not, typically speaking, the court will say, by the way, we had an unpublished ruling a few years ago that addressed this and we think it's right or we think it's wrong or whatever. Here, again, this is another unpublished ruling, so it's not binding, but Judge Decker in this case goes through a lot of cases, a long history of the Terry ruling and the law surrounding it. So let's do a little of that, right? Let's stop for a second, and before we dive into the court's reasoning in this case, let's talk about the Terry ruling. Remember here, if you go back to Terry versus Ohio, right? In Terry versus Ohio, the court looks at the observations of Officer McFadden, who sees people standing out on the street corner, appearing to, in the eyes of Officer McFadden, case this place, right? Case this this store potentially for a robbery. And Terry is this case where the court sort of invents this concept of the reasonable suspicion stop and the reasonable suspicion pat down, the search of a person for weapons. And when the court explains its reasoning here, the court says, and I'm quoting here from the 1968 Terry ruling itself, "In view of these facts, we cannot blind ourselves to the need for law enforcement officers to protect themselves and other prospective victims of violence in situations where they may lack probable cause for an arrest. When an officer is justified in believing that the individual whose suspicious behavior he is investigating at close range is armed and presently dangerous to the officer, it would appear to be clearly unreasonable to deny the officer the power to take necessary measures to determine whether the person is, in fact, carrying a weapon and to neutralize the threat of physical harm." So Terry talks about situations where an officer is investigating somebody who is engaged in suspicious behavior, and then, in addition to that, is potentially armed, engaging in that suspicious behavior. So we've talked a lot about issues like, do you have the lawful authority to pat somebody down for a weapon when you're stopping them in a traffic stop? And we've had other episodes about that. We've talked about that whole issue entirely. But here, right, notice that the issue kind of runs those two questions together. The suspicious behavior in Johnson, the suspicious behavior in the Avlin case from this week, both of those cases, the suspicious behavior is the being armed, right? There's not different suspicious behavior plus also being armed. Here, it's what makes you suspicious, the fact that you're carrying this firearm, right? So it's not an immediately easy question to answer, even just reading the Terry case. Now, being able to disarm somebody is something that the U.S. Supreme Court addressed in a case 4 years later in a case called Adams versus Williams. And they address the question of, okay, if I'm dealing with somebody who's potentially engaged in criminal activity, can I disarm them even if they might be lawfully armed, right? In other words, does it matter whether or not the person is lawfully armed or unlawfully armed? And in the Adams case, the U.S. Supreme Court seemed to say, no, it doesn't matter. In Adams versus Williams, and again, this is a case from 1972, the officer had information from an informant that provided him with reasonable suspicion to believe that Adams was engaged in narcotics distribution. And so the officer went to stop this gentleman and investigate whether or not, in fact, he was engaged in narcotics distribution. When he walks up to the vehicle, he develops reasonable suspicion also that Adams is armed. And as soon as he reaches Mr. Adams, he reaches inside of the vehicle and Sergeant Connolly, this is the officer in this case. Oh, excuse me, I keep saying Adams. The defendant in this case is Williams. I keep saying it's Adams, but it's Williams. Williams is the suspect. So Sergeant Connolly walks up and grabs Mr. Williams' firearm off of his person immediately when he comes up on him. And here, again, the court repeats the Terry ruling that when an officer is justified in believing that somebody whose suspicious behavior is investigating at close range is armed and presently dangerous, he can conduct a limited protective sweep for weapons. And the court here says, the purpose of this limited search is not to discover evidence of a crime, but to allow the officer to pursue his investigation without fear of violence. And thus, the frisk for weapons might be equally necessary and reasonable whether or not carrying a concealed weapon violated any applicable state law. Okay, so we know from the U.S. Supreme Court that it doesn't matter whether or not somebody is lawfully or unlawfully carrying a firearm. If I've lawfully detained that person and I'm investigating them for a crime, I can disarm them until my investigation is over, right? So we've got that kind of figured out from the U.S. Supreme Court, but now we're back to this question from the Johnson case, which is, okay, well, what if our suspicion is based almost entirely on the fact that the person is armed and we don't have another separate offense that we think that they're engaging in? Well, so here, the court, again, looks at the officer's testimony in this, and the officer is very clear. He can see a heavy object. It's heavier than a cell phone would be. It's swinging in the suspect's right pants pocket, and it swings every time he takes a step forward. And the officer adds, again, that every time he steps forward, the object's compressed between the pocket and the leg through the thin top fabric. He can clearly see the outline of a firearm, including both the handle and the barrel. And so here the court says, all right, well, you know, we got established here pretty clearly. He can see a firearm. Is there anything else we need to know? Well, yeah, the officer says. Here, the officer has worked for more than 2 years as a member of a special departmental team that patrols neighborhoods known for frequent shootings, burglaries, robberies, drug offenses, and other crimes. And on a regular basis, he encountered people that he believed to be armed. And in this case, he testified that he knew that this area was a high crime area in which arrests involving weapons and narcotics had been made. The officer said at the time of this encounter, the defendant in this case was walking next to an apartment complex at which the officer himself had made several arrests involving weapons, narcotics, and stolen vehicles. And the block that the suspect was walking from had been the location of a shooting during a very recent traffic stop. And so, again, like the Johnson case, the court is going to look at the totality of the circumstances. And the court here says the totality of circumstances, including the outline of the barrel and the handle of the firearm that was clearly visible through the thin fabric of his pants, supported the trial court's ruling that the officer reasonably believed that the suspect, the defendant in this case, was carrying a concealed weapon, which was a criminal offense. And here, the court looks back to a Virginia Supreme Court case called Whitaker versus Commonwealth. And Whitaker versus Commonwealth is a case going all the way back to 2010. And in Whitaker versus Commonwealth, again, the court examined, did the officer have a lawful basis to pat somebody down, to remove a firearm, and then arrest somebody for carrying a concealed weapon when they found a firearm on their person? And here in Whitaker, the court says, we will assume without deciding that a seizure of drugs, when they seize the drugs from the suspect, did rise to the level of full custodial arrest. But here the court says, we are of the opinion that the arrest for carrying a concealed weapon in the Whitaker case was lawful because it was supported by probable cause, supported by Whitaker's spontaneous statement that he had a firearm in his pocket. And that statement justified the search of his person for other weapons, during which the presence of the drugs was disclosed. Now, Whitaker had argued here, well, yeah, I admitted that I had, when the officers encountered me and I spoke to the officers and I said, hey, look, I got a gun on me, I said I had a gun on me, but they didn't know that my firearm possession was unlawful. How could they arrest me for carrying a concealed weapon and then search me and find my drugs if they didn't know that my possession of a firearm was unlawful? Well, here the court says proof of probable cause does not require evidence sufficient to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The fact that Whitaker might not have been convicted on the concealed weapons charge doesn't, on a showing that he had a permit, doesn't affect the viability of the probable cause to arrest the defendant based simply on the fact that he had a concealed firearm on or about his person, right? In other words, the court rejects here the defendant's argument that it's not a crime to simply possess the weapon, it's to possess it without a concealed weapon. And here, without verifying that he didn't have a concealed weapons permit, that the officers didn't have probable cause to arrest him for having the firearm. And so here in the Alvin case this week, the court says, the Supreme Court has held that carrying a concealed weapon provides probable cause to arrest, right? They say that's what that Whitaker case means. And we know that in the code itself, 18.2308 specifically says that it is an affirmative defense to the charge of carrying a concealed weapon that somebody has a valid concealed handgun permit. In other words, it's not something that you have to prove in court. He had a concealed handgun on or about his person and he didn't have a permit. No, you just have to prove he had a concealed handgun on or about his person. It's the defendant's burden to prove that he had a valid concealed handgun permit. That's what the code says. And so the court says, okay, well, if that's what the code says, and we have the Whitaker ruling from the Virginia Supreme Court, then what that means is that an officer can lawfully arrest somebody despite not knowing whether that person has a valid carry concealed carry permit. And so if that's the case, that can be probable cause to arrest somebody, then certainly an officer can conduct a Terry stop and pat down to determine whether or not the person has a concealed carry permit. And here again, the court quotes a lot of cases from other federal cases, other circuits, and so on. But the court says that's an objectively reasonable basis to seize somebody based on reasonable suspicion. The fact that the defendant carries a concealed handgun, which makes you inherently armed and dangerous, but also provides you with reasonable suspicion that the person is committing a criminal offense. So the court here applies these rulings and ultimately here says, okay, here in this case, is this simply the subjective opinion of the officer, or does the officer have an objective reason to stop the defendant? The court here says the officer has an objectively valid, reasonable reason to stop the defendant. The officer, who is experienced in looking for weapons in the possession of individuals in an area known for a significant number of weapon-related crimes, saw the clear outline of the handle and barrel of a firearm. He described his observations in detail. The trial court found the officer to be credible. So the court here says the described observations, coupled with the obvious weight of the object, the officer's experience, and the location of the encounter, justified the seizure of the defendant for a brief investigation to confirm or dispel his suspicions. And of course, since it's a weapon, a pat-down was lawful. And so the court holds the officer had reasonable suspicion to seize and then pat down the defendant for concealed weapons. So what's the rule, right? I mean, this is interesting, right? Because here we have the Johnson case, which I've taught many times now and I've explained to many officers, says you can't pat somebody down simply based upon seeing them carrying a firearm. And yet this past week in this Alvin case, which is a case from Norfolk, the court's saying quite the opposite, that actually you absolutely can do that. Well, one thing that I would point out about the Alvin case, which I think is really important, is the court is not necessarily rejecting what the Johnson case says. The Johnson case from 2020, as you remember, said, simply the fact that you see somebody who is carrying concealed firearm on another person doesn't give you a lawful authority to stop that person and pat them down. There has to be the concealed handgun plus something more. Well, let's go back and remember what were the things that in the Johnson case the court said could be something more. Well, the court specifically mentions, is the person in a high crime area? Well, in the Alvin case from this week, they were. They and the officer, not just high crime, like, you know, oh, there's a lot of larcenies from this area. No, specifically an area known for shootings, known for narcotics. There had been a shooting on that block just a few days before during a traffic stop. The officer himself had recovered weapons and narcotics from the apartment complex where the defendant is walking, where Alvin is walking. So not just some generalized, oh, this is a high crime area kind of testimony, but here the officer is giving really specific testimony. No. Like there's like shootings here. Like there was a shooting here a few days ago. I've gotten guns from, you know, right over here, right next to where the defendant is standing. Very specific, very detailed, very substantiated testimony. Some real facts other than just some general, oh yeah, it's a high crime area. What else could be something more? That's a complaint that the crime had just been committed by this, by the person. The court said that could add, that would maybe potentially be a basis to stop somebody and pat them down. Or furtive movements, that he was trying to conceal the firearm. You remember in Johnson, early when they walk up on him, it does kind of appear he's messing with his clothes, but he says he's been shot and he is wearing something that looks like bandages. So here we don't, in Johnson, the case from 2020, really don't have real like furtive movements, like he's trying to conceal the firearm on or about his person. The court here says also he could be acting suspiciously. He could be, for example, looking like he's casing a joint, which takes us all the way back to the Terry case, right? Where it looks like he's getting ready to rob somebody. And, you know, in the end, that's what Terry is talking about, right? Terry is talking about officers seeing something that draws their, some facts that that based on their training and experience, they can identify as, this gives me reason or taking suspicion to believe this person's engaging in some kind of criminal activity. And so seeing the firearm being unlawfully carried, plus being in a high crime area, or plus the furtive movements, or plus being a suspect in a crime, or plus being nervous and evasive and running away, that together in the totality of circumstances can potentially be enough to stop someone and pat them down. But I would point out here, and I think it's really interesting, that the court doesn't reference Johnson, and the Johnson case is really strongly worded. I think you're going to have to, in front of a trial court judge, whether it's general district court judge, circuit court judge, wherever you are, you're really going to have to articulate some specific facts. You can't just rely on, oh, he's nervous. Oh, he was sweating. Oh, it's a high crime area. I don't know that's going to cut it in the way that these cases are written, and with the kind of specificity that wins the day in the Alvin case, and the lack of specificity that costs the Commonwealth the case in the Johnson case. So, I hope today was helpful. I hope it was interesting. Remember, both these cases are unpublished, so neither of them are controlling. Neither of them, you know, tell us specifically what the law is, but they are both persuasive. And you can expect the Commonwealth and the defense to bring them both up, hopefully, if this ever comes up. So I hope this was interesting to you for today. I'm sorry it took so long to get another episode out, but I hope today was interesting. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. I do want to get on Spotify. I can't promise it's going to be the next couple of months. It's going to be really busy, but I will try to get you there. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, lots of other apps. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. Until next time, stay safe and don't get captured.